Chapter 16. An Unexpected Encounter. The walk back to the city was better than 2 miles, across low hills that worked the ache out of Matt's leg and put it back again before they topped a rise and saw Abu Dhar ahead, behind its extravagantly thick, white-plastered wall that no siege catapult had ever been able to break down. The city within was white, too, though here and there pointed domes bore thin stripes of color. The white-plastered buildings, white spires and towers, white palaces, gleamed even on a gray winter day. Here and there a tower ended in a jagged top, or a gap showed where a building had been destroyed. But in truth, the Seanchan conquest had occasioned little damage. They had been too fast, too strong, and in control of the city before more than scattered resistance could form. Surprisingly, such trade as there was this time of year had hardly faltered with the city's fall. The Seanchan encouraged it, though merchants and ship captains and crews were required to take an oath to obey the forerunners, await the return, and serve those who come home. In practice, that meant largely going about your life as usual, so few objected. The broad harbor was more crowded with ships every time Matt looked at it. This afternoon, it seemed he could have walked from Abu Dhar proper across to the Rahad, a rough quarter he would just as soon never revisit. Often in the days after he first managed to walk again, he had gone down to the docks to stare, not at the vessels with ribbed sails, or the seafolk ships that the Seanchan were re-rigging and manning with their own crews, but at craft flying the Golden Bees of Ilion, or the Sword in Hand of Ar-Adaman, or the Crescents of Tyr. He no longer did. Today he barely glanced toward the harbor. Those dice spinning in his head seemed to roar like thunder. Whatever was going to happen, he very much doubted he would like it. He seldom did, when the dice gave warning. Though a steady stream of traffic flowed out of the great arched gateway, and people afoot seemed to be squeezing through to get in, a thick column of wagons and ox carts, stretching all the way back to the rise, was waiting to enter and hardly moving. Everyone departing on a horse was Seanchan, whether with skin as dark as one of the sea folk or pale as a Kyrianin, and they stood out for more than being mounted. Some of the men wore voluminous trousers and odd tight coats with high collars that fit their necks snugly right to the chin, and rows of shiny metal buttons down the front, or flowing elaborately embroidered coats almost as long as a woman's dress. They were of the blood, as were the women in strangely cut riding dresses that seemed made of narrow pleats, with divided skirts cut to expose colorfully booted ankles and wide sleeves that hung to their feet in the stirrups. A few wore lace veils that hid all but their eyes, so their faces were not exposed to the lowborn. Most of the riders by far, however, wore brightly painted armor of overlapping plates. Some of the soldiers were women, too, though there was no way to tell which, with those painted helmets like the heads of monstrous insects. At least none wore the black and red of the Death Watch Guard. Even other Seanchan seemed nervous around them, and that was enough to warn Matt to walk wide around them. In any case, none of the Seanchan spared so much as a glance for 3 men and a boy slowly walking toward the city along the column of waiting carts and wagons. Well, the men walked slowly. Ulver skipped. Matt's leg was setting their pace, but he tried not to let the others see how much he was leaning on his staff. The dice usually announced incidents he managed to survive by the skin of his teeth. Battles. A building dropping on his head. Tylin. He dreaded what would happen when they stopped this time. Nearly all of the wagons and carts leaving the city had Seanchan driving or walking alongside, more plainly dressed than those on horses. Hardly peculiar looking at all, but those in the waiting line were more likely to belong to Abu Dhari or folk from the surrounding area. Men in long vests, women with their skirts sewn up on one side to expose a stockinged leg or colorful petticoats. Their wagons as well as their carts pulled by oxen. Outlanders dotted the column, merchants with small trains of horse-drawn wagons. There was more trade in winter here in the south than farther north, where merchants had to contend with snow-covered roads, and they came from far, some of them.
A stout Domani woman, with a dark beauty patch on her copper cheek, riding the lead of four wagons, clutched her flowered cloak around her and scowled at a man five wagons ahead of her in the line, a greasy-looking fellow, hiding long, thick mustaches behind a terrabonner veil, beside the wagon driver. A competitor, no doubt. A lean Kandori, with a large pearl in her left ear and silver chains across her chest, sat her saddle calmly, gloved hand folded on the pommel, maybe still unaware that her gray gelding and her wagon teams alike would be put into the lottery once she was into the city. One horse in five had been taken from locals, and so as not to discourage trade, one in ten from outlanders. Paid for, true, and a fair price in other days, but not nearly what the market would bear, given the demand. Matt always noticed horses, even if with only half his mind or less. A fat Kyrianin in a coat as drab as those of his wagon drivers was shouting angrily about the delay and letting his fine bay mare dance nervously. A very good confirmation on that mare. She would go to an officer, most likely. What was going to happen when the dice stopped? The wide-arched gates into the city had their guards, though it was likely only the Seanchan recognized them as such. Suldam, in their lightning-paneled blue dresses, threaded back and forth through the streams of traffic with gray-clad Domani on silvery Idam. Just one of those pairs would have been sufficient to quell any disturbance short of a full-scale assault, and maybe even that. But that was not the real reason for their presence. In the first days after Ebadar's fall, while he was still confined to bed, they had harrowed the city searching for the women they called Marath Domani, and now they made sure none could enter. The Suldam each carried an extra leash coiled on her shoulder just in case. Pairs patrolled the docks, too, meeting every arriving ship and boat. Beside the wide-arched gate into the city, a long platform displayed, on spikes 20 feet above the ground, the tarred but still recognizable heads of over a dozen men and two women, who had fallen afoul of Seanchan justice. Above them hung the symbol for that justice, a headsman's slant-edged axe, with the haft wrapped in an intricately knotted white cord. A placard below each head announced the crime that had placed it there, murder or rape, robbery with violence, assault on one of the blood. Lesser offenses brought fines or flogging, or being made dacoveil. The Seanchan were even-handed about it. None of the blood themselves were on display. One of those who earned execution would be sent back to Seanchan, or strangled with the white cord. But three of those heads had been attached to Seanchan, and the weight of their justice fell on high as well as low. Two placards marked Rebellion hung below the heads of the woman who had been mistress of the ships to the Athan Mier and her master of the blades. Matt had been through that gate often enough that he barely noticed the display now. Ulver skipped along singing a rhyming song. Beslin and Tom walked with their heads together, and once Matt caught a soft risky business from Tom, but he did not care what they were talking about. Then they were into the long, dim tunnel that carried the road through the wall, and the rumble of wagons passing through would have made listening impossible, even had he wanted to. Keeping close to the side, well away from the wagon wheels, Tom and Beslin forged ahead, talking in low murmurs, Ulver darting after them. But when Matt emerged into daylight again, he walked into Tom's back before he realized that all of them had stopped, hard beside the tunnel's mouth. On the point of making a caustic comment, he suddenly saw what they were staring at. People afoot pushing out of the tunnel behind him shoved them aside, but he just stared too. The streets of Ebudar were always full of people, but not like this, as though a dam had burst and sent a flood of humanity into the city. The throng packed the street in front of him from one side to the other, surrounding pools of livestock the like of which he had never seen before, spotted white cattle with long upswept horns, pale brown goats covered in fine hair that hung to the paving stones, sheep with four horns. Every street he could see looked as jammed. Wagons and carts inched through the mass where they moved at all, the shouts and curses of the wagon drivers and carters all but drowned in the babble of voices and the noise of the animals. He could not make out words, but he could distinguish accents. Slow, drawling Seanchan accents. Some of them nudged a neighbor and pointed at him in his bright clothing. They were gaping and pointing at everything, as if they had never seen an inn or a cutler's shop before. But he still growled under his breath and jerked his hat brim low over his eyes.
"The return," Tom muttered,
and if Matt had not been right at his shoulder, he would not have heard.
"While we were taking our ease with Luca, the Karen has arrived."
Matt had been thinking of this return that the Shanchen kept going on about as an invasion, an army. One of the wagon drivers shouted and waved her long-handled whip at some boys who had crawled up on the side of the wagon box to poke at what appeared to be grapevines in wooden tubs of earth. Another wagon held a long printing press, and still another, just managing to turn into the tunnel, carried what looked like brewer's vats and a faint smell of hops. Crates of strangely colored chickens and ducks and geese decorated some of those wagons, not birds for sale, but a farmer's stock. It was an army, all right, only not the sort he had imagined. This kind of army would be harder to fight than soldiers.
"Stab my eyes! We'll have to wade to get through this,"
Besslin grumbled in disgust, rising on his toes to try peering farther ahead over the crowd.
"How far before we find a clear street?"
Matt found himself remembering what he had not really seen when it was in front of his eyes, the harbor full of ships. Full of ships. Maybe two or three times the vessels that had been there when they left for Luca's camp at first light, quite a few of them still maneuvering under sail. Which meant there might be more still waiting to enter the harbor. Light. How many could have disgorged their cargo since morning? How many remained to be unloaded? Like, how many people could be carried on that number of ships? And why had they all come here instead of Tanchico? A shiver ran down his spine. Maybe this was not all of them.
"You had best try to find your way by back streets and alleys,"
he said, raising his voice so they could hear over the cacophony.
"You won't reach the palace before night otherwise."
Besslin turned a frown on him.
"You aren't returning with us? Matt, if you try to buy passage on a ship again, you know she won't go easy on you this time."
Matt matched the queen's son's scowl for scowl.
"I just want to walk around a little," he lied.
As soon as he returned to the palace, Tylin would start cosseting and petting him. It would not have been that bad, really. Not really. Except that she did not care who saw her caress his cheeks and whisper endearments in his ear. Even her son. Besides, what if the dice in his head stopped when he reached her? Possessive was hardly the word for Tylin these days. Blood and ashes, the woman might have decided to marry him. He did not want to marry, not yet. But he knew who he was going to marry, and it was not Tylin Quintara Mitsubar. Only, what could he do if she decided differently? Suddenly, he remembered Tom's murmur of risky business. He knew Tom, and he knew Besslin. Oliver was gaping at the Shanchan as hard as they themselves were at everything around them. He started to dart away for a closer look, and Matt seized his shoulder just in time and pushed him, protesting, into Tom's hands. "Take the boy back to the palace and give him his lessons when Rizel is done with him. And forget whatever madness you have in mind. You could put your heads on display outside the gate, and Tylin's too." And his own. Never let that be forgotten. The two men stared back at him without any expression, as good as confirming his suspicions.
"Perhaps I should walk with you," Tom said at last. "We could talk. You're remarkably lucky, Matt, and you have a certain flair for, shall we say, the adventurous."
Besslin nodded. Over squirmed in Tom's grip, trying to stare at all the strange people at once and unconcerned with what his elders were talking about. Matt grunted sourly. Why did people always want him to be a hero? Sooner or later, that sort of thing was going to get him killed. "I don't need to talk about anything. They are here, Besslin. If you couldn't stop them getting in, sure as morning, you won't be able to push them out. Rand will deal with them, if the rumors are anything to go by." Again, those whirling colors spun through his head, almost obliterating the sound of the dice for an instant. "You took that bloody oath to wait on the return. We all did." Refusal had meant being put in chains and set to work on the docks or clearing the canals in the Rahad. Which made it no oath at all in his book. "Wait on Rand." The colors came once more and vanished.
Blood and ashes, he just had to stop thinking about certain people. Again they swirled. It might come out right yet, if you give it time. You don't understand, Matt, Beslin said fiercely. Mother still sits on the throne, and Siroth says she will rule all of Altara, not just what we hold around Ebu Dar, and maybe more besides. But Mother had to lie down on her face and swear fealty to some woman on the other side of the Arith Ocean. Siroth says I should marry one of their blood and shave the sides of my head, and Mother is listening to her. Siroth might pretend they are equals, but she has to listen when Siroth speaks. No matter what Siroth says, Ebu Dar isn't really ours anymore, and the rest won't be either. Maybe we can't push them out by force of arms, but we can make the country too hot to hold them. The White Cloaks found out. Ask them what they mean by the Altaran Noon. Matt could guess without asking anyone. He bit his tongue to keep from pointing out that there were more Shonchan soldiers in Ebu Dar than there had been White Cloaks in all of Altara during the White Cloak War. A street full of Shonchan was no place for a flapping tongue, even if most did appear to be farmers and craftsfolk. I understand you're hot to put your head on a spike, he said quietly as he could and still be heard in that din of voices and cattle lowing and geese honking. You know about their listeners. That fellow over there who looks like a stableman could be one, or that skinny woman with the bundle on her back. Beslin glowered so hard at the pair, Matt had pointed out, that if they really were listeners, they might report him for that alone. Maybe you'll sing a different song when they reach Andor, he growled, and pushed his way into the throng, shoving anyone who got in his way. Matt would have been unsurprised to see a fight break out. He suspected that was what the man was looking for. Tom turned to follow with Ulver, but Matt caught his sleeve. Cool his temper if you can, Tom, and cool your own while you're about it. I would think by this time you'd have had enough of shaving blind.
My head is cool, and I'm trying to cool his, Tom said dryly. He can't just sit, though. It is his country.
A faint smile crossed his leathery face.
You say you won't take risks, but you will. And when you do, you'll make anything Beslin and I might try look like an evening stroll in the garden. With you around, even the barber is blind. Come along, boy, he said, swinging Ulver up onto his shoulders. Rizel might not let you rest your head if you're late for your lesson.
Matt frowned after him as he strode away, making much better progress with Ulver straddling his neck than Beslin had. What did Tom mean? He never took risks unless they were forced on him. Never. He glanced casually toward the skinny woman and the fellow with the dung on his boots. Like they could be listeners. Anybody could be. It was enough to set a prickle between his shoulders, as if he were being watched. He inched a goodly distance along streets that actually grew thicker with people and animals and wagons the nearer he came to the docks. The stalls on the bridges over the canals had their shutters down. The street peddlers had picked up their blankets, and the tumblers and jugglers that usually entertained at every street crossing would have had no room to perform if they had not gone away too. There were too many Shonchan. That was how many there were, and maybe one in five a soldier, plain enough by their hard eyes and the set of their shoulders, so different from farmer or craftsman, even when they were not wearing armor. Now and then a group of Suldam and Damani moved along the street in a little eddy of clear space, more even than soldiers got. It was not given out of fear, at least not by the Shonchan. They bowed respectfully to the women with lightning-marked red panels on the blue dresses, and smiled with approval as the pairs passed by. Beslin was out of his mind. The Shonchan were not going to be driven off by anyone except an army of Ashaman, like the one rumor said had fought them to the east a week ago. Or one armed with the Illuminator's secrets. What in the light could a Ludra want with a Bellfounder? He took pains not to come in sight of the docks. He had learned his lesson on that. What he really wanted was a game of dice, one that would last well into the night. Preferably late enough that Tylin would be asleep when he returned to the palace. She had taken away his dice, claiming she did not like him gambling, though she did it after he talked her into wagering forfeits while he was still confined to bed. Fortunately, dice could always be found, and with his luck, it was always better to use the other man's dice anyway. Unfortunately, once he discovered she was not about to pay a forfeit of letting him go, the woman pretended not to know what he was talking about. He had used them to give her back a bit of her own medicine. A grave mistake, however much fun it had been at the time. Since the forfeits ran out, she had been twice as bad as before. The taverns and common rooms he entered were as packed as the streets, though, with barely room to lift a mug, much less toss dice, full of Shonchan laughing and singing, and glum-faced Ebu Dare, who eyed the Shonchan in sullen silence. He still queried the innkeepers and tapsters on the chance they might have a cubbyhole he could rent, but one and all, they shook their heads. He had not really expected anything else. There had been nothing available even before all the new arrivals. Still, he began to feel as gloomy as the foreign merchants he saw peering into their wine and wondering how they were going to get their goods out of the city with no horses. He had gold to pay whatever Luca wanted, and more, but it was all in a chest in the Tarasin Palace, and he was not about to try taking enough out in one go, not after palace servants had carried him back from the docks like a stag taken in hunt. All he had been doing then was talking to ship captains. If Tylan learned, and she would, that he was trying to leave the palace with more gold than he needed for an evening of gambling. Oh no, he had to have a room, a garret in some inn's attic the size of a wardrobe, anything, where he could hide away gold a little at a time, or he had to have a chance with the dice, one or the other. Luck or no luck, though, he eventually realized that he was going to find neither today. And those bloody dice were still tumbling in his head. Tumbling. He did not stay in any one place long, and not just for the lack of a game or a room. His colorful clothes, his shame a tinker for brightness clothes, drew eyes. Some of the Shonchan thought he was there for entertainment and tried to pay him to sing. He almost let them once or twice, but once they heard him, they would have demanded the money back. Some of the Ebu Dare men, with long curved knives tucked behind their belts and a belly full of anger they could not take out on the Shonchan, thought to take it out on the buffoon who lacked only a painted face to look like a noble's fool. Matt ducked back into the crowded street whenever he saw such fellows eyeing him. He had learned the hard way that he was in no condition for a fight yet, and his killer's head going up beside the city gate would do him no good at all. Matt took rest where he could find it, on an empty barrel abandoned beside the mouth of an alleyway, on the rare bit of bench in front of a tavern that had room for one more, on a stone step until the building's owner came out and knocked his hat off with a swipe of her broom. His belly was kissing his backbone. He was beginning to feel that everyone was gaping at his garish clothes. The dank cold was seeping into his bones, and the only dice he was going to find were those still thundering away in his head like horses' hooves. He did not think they had ever been this loud before. "Nothing for it but to go back and be the queen's bloody pet," he growled, using his staff to lever himself up off a cracked wooden crate lying at the side of the street. Several passers-by looked at him as if his face were already painted. He ignored them. Beneath his notice, they were. He was not beating them over the head with his staff as they deserved, goggling at a man that way. The streets really were as full as earlier, he realized, and it would be well after nightfall before he got back to the palace if he tried to make his way through the crowds. Of course, Tylan might be asleep by then. Maybe. His stomach growled, almost loudly enough to drown out the dice. She might order the kitchens not to feed him if he was too late. 10 hard-won paces through the press, and he turned down an alley, narrow and dark. There were no paving stones. The white plaster on the windowless walls was cracked and falling to expose the brick beneath, often as not. The air was rank with the fetid stench of decay, and he hoped that what squished under his boots was mud, even when it gave off a loathsome odor. There were no people, either. He could step out with a good stride. Or what passed for one today. He could hardly wait for the day he could walk a few miles again without panting and aching and needing to lean on a stick. Twisting alleys, most so narrow his shoulders brushed both sides,
crisscrossed the city in a maze that was easy to get lost in if you did not know your way. He never took a wrong turn, even when a narrow, crooked passage suddenly forked into three or even four that all seemed to meander in roughly the same direction. There had been a good many times in Ebudar when he needed to avoid eyes, and he knew these alleys like he knew his own hand, though oddly enough he still had the feeling he was being watched. He expected to feel that as long as he had to wear those bloody clothes. If he had to struggle through a mass of people and animals from one alley to another, and occasionally shove his way across a bridge that seemed a solid wall of humanity, he was still almost back to the palace in the time it would have taken him to go three streets otherwise. Hurrying into the shadowed passage between a well-lit tavern and a shuttered lacquerware shop, he wondered what the kitchens would have ready. More capacious than most, wide enough for three if they were friendly, this alley led out onto the Molhara Square, almost in front of the Tarasin Palace. Suroth was living there, and the cooks had been outdoing themselves since she had had the lot of them flogged after her first meal. There might be oysters with cream, and perhaps gilded fish, and squid with peppers. 10 strides into the shadows, his foot came down on something that did not squish, and he went down in the freezing mud with a grunt, twisting at the last instant, so he did not land on his bad leg. Icy liquid immediately soaked through his coat. He hoped it was water. He grunted again when boots landed on his shoulder. The fellow toppled off of him, cursing and skidding deeper into the alley on the mud, and went to one knee, just managing to catch himself against the side of the tavern short of falling flat himself. Matt's eyes were accustomed to the dim light, enough for him to make out a slender, nondescript man. A man with what appeared to be a large scar on his cheek. Not a man, though. A creature he had seen rip out his friend's throat with one bare hand and take a knife out of its own chest and throw it back at him. And the thing would have landed right in front of him, in easy reach, if he had not tripped. Maybe a little twist of Tavirin shaping had worked in his favor, thank the light. All that flashed through his head in the time it took the golem to catch itself against the wall and turn its head to glare at him. With an oath, Matt snatched his falling walking staff and awkwardly hurled it at the creature like a spear. At its legs, hoping to tangle them, gain a moment. The thing flowed aside like water, avoiding the staff, boots sliding a little in the mud, then threw itself toward Matt. The delay had been enough, though. As soon as the staff left his hand, Matt fumbled inside his shirt for the foxhead medallion, breaking the leather cord as he snatched the medallion out. The golem threw itself at him, and he swung the medallion desperately. Silver that had lain cool on his chest brushed across an outstretched hand with a hiss like bacon frying and a smell of burning flesh. Fluid as quicksilver, snarling, the thing tried to dodge by the whirling medallion to seize some part of Matt. Once it laid hands on him, he was as good as dead. It would not try to toy with him this time, as it had in the Rahad. Flailing continuously, he caught it with the fox head on the other hand, across the face, each time with a hiss and stench of burning, as if he had struck with a hot iron. Teeth bared, the golem backed away, but in a crouch on the balls of its feet, hands clawed, ready to jump at the slightest weakness. Not letting the spinning medallion slow, Matt pushed unsteadily to his feet, watching the thing that looked like a man. "He wants you dead as much as he wants her," it had told him in the Rahad, smiling. It was not talking or smiling now. He did not know who the her was, or the he, but the rest was clear as good glass. And here he was, barely able to stay on his feet. His leg and hip ached like fire, and his ribs. Not to mention the shoulder the golem had landed on. He had to get back to the street, back among people. Maybe enough people would deter the thing. A small hope, but the only hope he could see. The street was not far. He could hear the babble of voices, hardly softened by distance at all. He took a careful step backward. His boot slid in something that gave off a foul smell and threw him against the tavern's wall. Only frantic swings of the silver fox head kept the golem back. Those voices in the street were so tantalizingly close. They might as well have been in Barsin. Barsin was long dead, and he would be too, soon.
"He's down this alley," a man shouted. "Follow me! Hurry! He'll get away!"
Matt kept his eyes on the golem. Its gaze flickered beyond him toward the street, and it hesitated.
"I am ordered to avoid notice, save by those I harvest," it spat at him. "So you will live a little longer. A little longer."
Spinning, it ran down the alley, slipping a little in the mud, yet still seeming to flow as it dodged around behind the tavern. Matt ran after it. He could not have said why, except that it had tried to kill him, would try again, and his hackles were stiff. So it was going to kill him at leisure, was it? If the medallion could hurt it, maybe the medallion could kill it. Reaching the corner of the tavern, he saw the golem at the same time that it glanced back and saw him. Again the thing hesitated for an instant. The tavern's back door stood ajar, letting out the sounds of revelry. The creature stuck its hands into a hole left by a missing brick in the back wall of the building opposite the tavern, and Matt stiffened. It hardly seemed to need weapons, but if it had hidden one in there, he did not think he would survive facing that thing with any sort of weapon. Arms followed hands, and then the golem's head went into the hole. Matt's jaw dropped. The golem's chest slithered through, its legs, and it was gone. Through an opening maybe the size of Matt's two hands.
"I don't think I've ever seen the like," someone said quietly beside him.
And Matt gave a start at realizing he was no longer alone. The speaker was a stoop-shouldered, white-haired old man with a large, hooked nose planted in the middle of a sad face and a bundle slung on his back. He was sliding a very long dagger into a sheath beneath his coat.
"I have," Matt said hollowly, "in Shadar Logoth."
Sometimes bits of his own memory he thought lost floated up out of nowhere, and that one had just surfaced, watching the golem. It was one memory he wished had remained lost.
"Not many survive a visit there,"
the old man said, peering at him. His weathered face looked familiar somehow, but Matt could not place him.
"Whatever took you to Shadar Logoth?"
"Where are your friends?" Matt said. "The people you were shouting to." The alleyway held only the two of them. The sounds from the street continued unabated and undisturbed by any cries about anyone getting away if they did not hurry. The old man shrugged.
"I'm not certain anyone out there understood what I was shouting. It's hard enough understanding them. Anyway, I thought it might scare off the fellow. Seeing that, though..."
Gesturing toward the hole in the wall, he laughed mirthlessly, showing gaps in his teeth.
"I think maybe you and I both have the Dark One's own luck."
Matt grimaced. He had heard that too often about himself, and he did not like it. Mainly because he was not sure it was not true.
"Maybe we do," he muttered.
"Forgive me. I should introduce myself to the man who saved my neck. I'm Matt Cawthon. Are you new come to Ebu Dar?" That bundle strapped to the fellow's back gave him the look of a man on the move. "We'll have a hard time finding a place to sleep." He took care with the gnarled hand the other man put in his. It was all knobs, as if every bone had been broken at the same time, and had healed badly. It had a strong grip, though.
"I'm Noel Charin," Matt Cawthon. "No, I have been here some time, but my pallet in the attic of the Golden Ducks is now occupied by a fat Ilianer oil merchant who was rousted from his room this morning in favor of a Shon Chan officer. I thought I'd find somewhere back in this alley for tonight."
Rubbing the side of his big nose with a crooked, knobby finger, he chuckled as if sleeping in an alley were of no moment.
"It will not be the first time I've slept rough, even in a city."
"I think I can do better for you than that," Matt told him. But the rest of what he had been going to say died on his tongue.
The dice were still spinning in his head, he realized. He had managed to forget them, with the golem trying to kill him, but they were still bouncing, still waiting to land. If they were warning of something worse than the golem, he did not want to know. Only he would. There was no doubt of that. He would, when it was too late.